I was born in a small town called Masjid Suleiman in southern Iran.
I was born in Syria.
I was born in Hamburg, Germany.
I was born in Korea.
I was born in Tanzania in a refugee camp.
I was born in Singapore.
Guatemala. I'm from Ireland.
I was born in Thailand, refugee
camp. I was born in Mumbai.
I was born in Vientiane, Laos.
I was born in England.
I was born in Costa Rica.
Welcome to Many Roads to Here, bringing the voices of immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers to a national conversation about migration and identity. I'm your host, Meg Ritter. The Immigrant Story has been hosting live storytelling events in the Portland, Oregon area since 2019. Today, we bring you our fourth episode in this podcast series, The Immigrant Story Live, which features stories from the stage stitched together by theme. Today's episode is about the family bonds we form, the power of these bonds. The bonds between parents and children, brothers and sisters, spouses, our extended families, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, and sometimes strong bonds form beyond our families of origin to include our teachers and coworkers, our neighbors and friends. Each of our storytellers today tell of the bonds that refuse to be broken by war, violence, physical separation, poverty, hardship, trauma, and unimaginable suffering, because these bonds are ones of love. Our first storyteller, Jane Mantry, a retired trauma psychologist, an actor, writer, U.S. Army veteran, and activist. Jane was born in Indonesia shortly after the Indonesian Revolution. She says of her father,
"He had one goal, and that was to get his family safely to America. But unfortunately, it was the 1950s, and U.S. immigration was not interested in allowing refugees from Indonesia into this country, even if they had a daughter with the American name Jane. But my father would not give up."
Listen as Jane tells her story. See Jane run.
"War is hell. My parents survived two wars, World War II and the Indonesian Revolution that followed. And although those wars ended, my parents' trauma never did. And so tonight, I want to dedicate my story to my parents. I was my parents' only daughter. My father was a proud, brave, and loving man who lived for the dream of becoming an American. My mother was a survivor. She carried with her the secrets of those wars. She and my father had more than a marriage. They had a trauma bond. She was a devoted wife, and she would follow my father all the days of her life. I was born in Indonesia, as were my parents, my grandparents, and my great-grandparents. I am what is called an Indo, a blend of Indonesian from my indigenous grandmothers and great-grandmothers, and European from my forefathers who colonized Indonesia back in the 1700s. When I was born in Jakarta, Indonesia, my father proudly announced that my name would be Jane, because one day I was going to be an American. He had one goal, and that was to get his family safely to America. But unfortunately, it was the 1950s, and U.S. immigration was not interested in allowing refugees from Indonesia into this country, even if they had a daughter with the American name Jane. But my father would not give up. You see, a few years earlier, my father's beloved sister was brutally murdered in a massacre on her way home. She was killed by Indonesian militants hell-bent on killing anyone with European heritage. We had to leave. My father was fiercely protective. Nothing was going to happen to his daughter, who with each passing day reminded him more and more of his sister Deitje. The The only option was to wait in the Netherlands, but it gets complicated. You see, my father said that he hated the Dutch. As an Indo, he had experienced racism by the Dutch in the colonies. Also, shortly after World War II broke out, he was drafted into the Dutch military. He was captured, and for 4 years, he was shackled, tortured, forced to build railroads. When he was finally released by the Japanese, apparently the Dutch government turned their backs on the Indo soldiers. And I'm not really clear about all the details, but what I am clear about was that something went wrong. But still, with no other options, and knowing that going to Europe would be a stepping stone to getting to America, my father boarded that ship to the Netherlands. And my mother, clutching her baby girl named Jane, followed him. We waited in the Netherlands through 6 long, cold, bleak winters. My best friend in The Hague had beautiful blonde hair and blue eyes, and we always played together at my house. But I was never invited inside of her house. I always had to wait outside. And one day, while I was waiting outside, I looked through her open window, and I saw her grandmother knitting. And without speaking, her grandmother got up and passed the knitting needles to me through the open window. And she gently guided my fingers with the yarn, repeating the stitches, knit purl, knit purl. And there began my knitting lessons outside that open window. As a child in the Netherlands, there was a lot that I didn't question. I did not question why I belonged on the outside of that open window. I did not question why my father seldom smiled or why my mother often cried in the middle of the day while my father was at work. There was a lot that I didn't know. I didn't know that our long wait was almost over. I didn't know that my mother was packing everything she could into a steamer trunk, her wok, her rice steamer, a dress that she made for me by hand so that I would look nice when the church people came to pick us up in America. She packed away her college diploma, which in Jakarta allowed her to teach in a prestigious school. But in the United States, that diploma only allowed her to wash dishes in our school cafeteria. She was allergic to the detergent, and her hands would bleed. She worked hard for that diploma. Her studies were often interrupted when the sirens would go off, and she would have to jump on the back of a Red Cross truck in search for shelter. Sometimes that was an option, and sometimes it wasn't. She packed away her memories, never telling anyone what they did to her during those wars. She packed everything she could into that steamer trunk, each item dripping with her grief and her unspoken trauma. And then my father boarded the ship, this time to America, and my mother followed him. We arrive in America. We arrive in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on a hot August day. And the church people came to pick us up, not with tuk-tuks, not on bicycles, but in huge cars. And they're speaking words I don't understand. But to my amazement, when I opened my first school textbook, there is one word that I can read. Jane. See, Jane, run. I don't know what that means. I think it means I, Jane, am now in America. And there are lots of kids in my school with beautiful blonde hair and blue eyes, but they stare at me. My mother says that it's because we're different. Americans don't like dark, she explains. And when Michael, the blonde boy, kicks me and repeatedly punches me, chanting, words that I don't understand, I know that my mother is right. And when the two boys, the brothers, the policeman's sons, who live across the street in the gray and the red house, when they repeatedly punch me and chant, "Go back to where you came from," I know my mother is right. But I don't tell her what is happening because the sadness in her eyes is bigger than the sadness in my eyes. I am almost 13 years old, and we are at the courthouse in Milwaukee on a very special day. So I am wearing a special dress. It is called a shift. It's got the straight lines. It's beige. It's got a ruffle across the chest and a ribbon that flows all the way down to the hemline. I wear that dress on that special day, and I wear it to my church confirmation. I also wear it almost every day of my eighth grade year at Samuel Morris Junior High School because it is the only nice dress in my closet. On that day at the courthouse, we are declared American citizens. My father says, "Jane, from now on when they say, 'What are you?' you say, 'I am an American.'" I am an American, I repeat, out of love and respect for my father. And then he led us out of the courthouse, and my mother followed him. The years come and go. I move west to Oregon, and I marry an American with beautiful blue eyes. I cook delicious meals, steak, pot roast, turkey. And I pretend that none of those things are foreign to me. I even make gravy from a recipe on the back of an Argo cornstarch box. You know, sometimes it's just not that hard to be an American. My parents retire to Arizona, and I raise a beautiful family in Eugene. My father is dying of cancer. I fly out to see him one last time. Heavily sedated on morphine, he hears my voice and he opens his eyes. And for the first time, I see a look of fear and terror in his eyes. Softly but fiercely, he utters, "Run! Run!" I realize he's seeing his sister, Daisha. "Papa, it's me, Jane." He's undeterred. "Run, run." I try another tactic. "Papa, don't worry, I am strong. I can run fast." "No, you are small. Run." His eyes close. We bury my father. My mother sings his favorite hymn at his funeral, and we get in the car together to go to the reception. She turns to me, and for the first time, I see no sadness in her eyes. It is as if the trauma has lifted. She says, "Jane, I am going with him." And before we get to the reception, she has a fatal heart attack. My parents had more than a marriage. They had a trauma bond. Before his death, my father picked out a single grave headstone for them, and prophetically he had it engraved, "Together forever." My father left this world, and my mother followed him. Thank you.
Telling this story, see Jane run on stage and receiving a heartfelt reception from the audience, led Jane to write a memoir in 2023 of the same title. Since then, her story, See Jane Run, has expanded into a one-woman play and now even a documentary. In the introduction of her memoir, Jane writes, "My life has been a lesson in resilience, compassion, joy, and love. The greatest of these is love. Our next storyteller, Shan Pon Sinlapasi's life began in Laos towards the end of a civil war, now referred to as the Secret War. For 9 long years, from 1964 to 1973, the equivalent of an entire plane load of bombs dropped from the sky every 8 minutes, 24 hours a day, on an area the size of Oregon. This bombing campaign was kept secret from the U.S. public until whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg's release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971. Today, Laos remains the most heavily bombed country per capita in history. When Shan Pon was 4 years old in 1979, she and her family managed to escape Laos. Her family stuck together, from navigating foreign airports, living in a refugee camp in Thailand, to sleeping 20 people in a one-bedroom apartment once safely in the United States. But for Shan Pon, familial bonds extended beyond her family of origin to include her neighborhood community, her teacher, Miss Bates, and eventually her co-workers at Rambas.
I was blessed because I had a teacher that cared for me. She saw me. She believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. Miss Bates.
Sometimes love looks like belief in safety, in a dream, belief in each other. Sometimes love can look like a push in the right direction. Listen in on Shan Pon's story, I'm Not Supposed to Be Here.
Sabaidi Pi Mai! Happy New Year, everyone. My life began in Pathet Lao towards the end of the Secret War. As the oldest daughter, I was supposed to stay in the village, care for my cousins, my family, and marry a good man to help care for my elders. Every 8 minutes, 24 hours a day, for 9 years, we had cluster bombs, plane loads, drop on my country. My dad and my uncles were child soldiers in the military. They came to rescue us in the middle of the night. My mom put me on her back, said, Su Hai, Su Bak, do not speak, do not cry. As she carried me on her back and ran barefoot through the jungles. When we arrived on the boat, I ran, crouched down as I watched the fires from the guns shooting at us. When we arrived in Thailand, first thing we received was a blue blanket that was to help keep the family warm. We lived in makeshift huts, no windows, no doors, just the dirt floor. My family, like every other family, we slept on dirt with the animals. I was sick a lot. I had malaria and almost died. The planes, the only planes we ever saw, were the ones flying overhead. All of a sudden, we were told, you're getting on a plane. You're going to meet your sponsor. What? What's a sponsor? What did they even look like? When we got to Los Angeles, California, we were notified. Our sponsor was sent off on a mission to Africa. we missed our connecting flight. We had our refugee outfit on, the best that we could have, with our little badge that identified us as refugee. Our entire life was in a white bag that we carried around the airport that was identified us from the United Nations High Commissioners of Refugee. That was our life. We didn't know where to go. Through the kindness of a nice Filipina lady who saw us struggling, she helped us find where we needed to go. When we arrived in Stockton, California, my uncle met us with a smile, and we moved in with him in his one-bedroom apartment, all 20 of us sleeping in a line. But perspective, living from a refugee camp, we now had a door, a window. The sounds of the cars zooming by was, guess what? Soothing compared to the sounds of the planes. In 1980, Stockton was mainly farmland. And so we as young children would get up really early before the sun came up and went and helped our family pick crops, strawberries, watermelons, corn, whatever was in season. We would pick as fast as we could, put it in the buckets, and go weigh them because we were paid by the buckets. After that, when the sun came up, we were off to school, study as hard as we could, then released back home. When we got home, we would help our parents work again, go to sleep, repeat all over again. My parents worked 2 to 3 jobs, and often my mom, late at night, would come home with assembly boards. And all 20 of us, with our tiny little fingers, because we were quick, knew how to assemble so fast to make ends meet. Growing up in Section 8 housing, I was surrounded by Latinos, Africans, Asians from all over the world. For me, I was so happy and carefree during this time, but probably not for my family. This was the first time ever I was in community where people were not judging me by the color of my skin, the accent that I held, or the class that I ranked in. We were in community, all of us, as human beings. We may not speak the same language, but we were all helping each other survive. In these communities that I lived in, poverty was evident. The need to survive was constant. And it was very clear. We had young kids with loaded guns, those who were victims of a crime, and those who perpetrated. These were my friends. These were my family. These were my neighbors. This was the community that taught me about fighting for each other. In community, I learned a lot. At age 8, I just got to America, barely spoke the language, but I was told I had to go be my parents' interpreter. I had to fill out their forms. I had to answer their phone calls. I had to wait in line, Social Security, the doctor's office, at immigration. I saw how they treated my family. I saw how they treated my community. We were ignored, rushed off, and often yelled at for not understanding. These moments left a permanent scar deep. In these communities, I realized that if we were ever at a park just hanging out, eating like we do, sharing food, and the sound of a gun went off, or a gang fight would begin, my job was to run. I could not be a witness. I could not get into a gang fight. I could not be involved. I knew if for any of those things, law enforcement would show up for the murders. And for me, if I was in the wrong place, the wrong time, got locked up in a gang fight, guess what? I would not be standing here. My parents worked a lot, so I was blessed because I had people who cared for me, specifically my grandparents. They taught me early on that girls from Laos, especially from where we grew up, were not allowed to have an education. So I had to study. But my metout, my grandma, she said to me, Pon, if you're going to study, aujaisai, put your heart into it. Do not do anything halfway. Aujaisai. That stuck with me. To me, growing up, what was an education? I was told from a very young age to marry a good man, to find a good man, to learn to cook, to clean, so I could keep a good man. I almost flunked out of high school because why study? Why go to college? What was the utility of an education if my husband was supposed to care for me? I was blessed because I had a teacher that cared for me. She saw me. She believed in me when I didn't believe in myself, Miss Bates. She gave me my first book, Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. She knew I loved to read, even though English was my second language and I was slow. I loved to read because it took you to faraway places and made you rethink how you thought you were thinking. And after I finished that book, she kept giving me books over and over again. And one day, she sat me down and she said to me, Pon, what is going on? I see you reading. I see you love reading. But you're flunking. You keep telling me you want to help your family get out of poverty. But you're limiting yourself. You're stopping yourself. You are your own worst enemy right now. Those words hurt. Those words stung. But guess what? Those were the words that made me cry and reflect. What was I doing with my life? The words of my grandmother, the words of Miss Bates, it made me challenge myself. It made me rethink. It's changed my life's perspective. I realized if I focused on me, I would lift my family. I would lift my community. It was a game changer. I graduated, went to junior college, and then got a dual degree from Santa Clara University. When I was my senior year, I had to work. And I got a wonderful opportunity to work at Rambus, a semiconductor company in Mountain View, California. The chief financial officer, when he met me, was so kind. He had a daughter that was the same age as me. And he said to me, first thing he said to me, what do you want to do with your life? I blurted out with so much enthusiasm, I want to be a lawyer. And then I sat there for a moment. I never knew a lawyer. Haven't met one, worked with one. But I knew in the communities that I grew up, lawyers were the last resort in helping our community. And I wanted to help people. At Rambus, it was the first time ever that I met female engineers. I met top executives that looked like me, thought like me, ate like me. And you know what? More importantly, they believed in me. When I could not afford a really expensive calculator, the TI-85, they all pitched their money in together to surprise me with it. And when they did that, I worked so hard because I wanted them to be proud. I got an A. And then when I got accepted to law school, they shut down the entire company to throw me a party. They put all their money together and gave me the most generous gift card so that I would not feel alone, so that I could buy furniture without worrying about money. These people will forever have a place in my heart. My elders have always taught me, Pawn, you must always give back. When we got to America, we didn't have much, but my aunts, my uncles, my elders would often open their homes, share their food, and assist everyone else who was new to America navigate the intricacies and the hardship of our systems. Through them, I realized how important it was to give back. My elders taught me how to community organize before we had a term for community organizing. It was them and countless others that pushed me to go to law school. I applied at Northwestern School of Law, Lewis and Clark College, because then it was the number one law school in public interest law. I wanted to give back to ordinary people like myself and my family who struggled. I wanted to focus on survivors of domestic violence, those facing immigration, and those who were stuck with elder law issues. Lewis and Clark gave me that opportunity. I also, at Lewis and Clark, wanted to really be connected to the community. So during that time period, I reached out to Immigrant Refugee Community Organization, IRCO, and Catholic Charities because I wanted to be immersed in community. And there, I was given the opportunity to work with the most vulnerable in our state and our nation. I worked with survivors of domestic violence, women and children who were survivors of human trafficking. I also dealt with gang violence and immigration. But the best thing that I got to do, and what I loved to do, was to teach every single person walking through those doors their legal rights, navigating these systems. In those experiences, I realized that our system of law and society does not have the best process in dealing with trauma, PTSD. I saw systems that often would take in but spit out without rehabilitating. It was there that I saw that this is not how life had to be for our community. I wanted to be that difference. I decided in 2017, during the travel ban, I witnessed some of the hardest things for our foreign nationals and US citizens. It was the first time in my life and my legal career that we were actually witnessing US citizens denied entry into the United States. During that time period, me and my friends realized we were at the airport filing all these petitions that I, as a lawyer, could file 1,000 petitions, but I did not have the power to interpret the law so that it can apply fairly and equally to every human being. It was then, and it was there, that I decided I must become a judge. People like me, who grew up in a refugee camp, women like me, who lived on the tougher side of town, were often told we could not be state judges. I should not be here, but I am here. I am living my ancestors' dreams. I am caring for my community and my family, the thing I love to do the most. I am making sure that every person is seen, heard, and valued. I am the first Lao judge, ethnic Lao judge, in the nation. Khop Jai.
The Honorable Champone Sinla Posse continues to preside as a county judge in Oregon, where she makes sure each day that everyone is seen, heard, and valued. What her family deserved every step of the way, what we all deserve. Like our first two storytellers today, Saran Coote, our final teller, shares of a lived experience enmeshed in war. But it is also a story awash in love. Growing up in Cambodia, when Saran was just 5 years old in 1975, the Khmer Rouge, a brutal communist regime, took over the country, killing his father, and shortly thereafter, coming back to take away his mother.
But my mother was strong. She did not cry. She later told me the reason why. She said, if I cry, I will give them a reason to take you too. So they take her away from us and left the children with our old grandmother.
Listen as Saran tells his story, The Heaven Between.
War. My family know a lot about war. We were born into war. See, my mother was born when the Japanese occupied Cambodia in the 40s. She never met her father, because he was killed 7 months before she was born. I was born when the American was dropping bombs on us, and I lived through the genocide. War made me grow up faster, and I bear the responsibility a lot earlier in life. I remember when I was 5 years old, and my sister was a three-year-old. We were bathing in the reservoir outside our village temple in Chongkal, Cambodia. We were having fun until suddenly she reached a part too deep for her feet to reach bottom. I saw her head slip under, so I jumped in after her. My arms and legs struggled because I didn't know how to swim. But I was taller than her and managed to grab her arms and pull her to safety. That was the day I became a responsible human being. War is ugly, and war is evil. April 17, 1975 was the day that hell was unleashed on the Cambodian people. That was when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia and they killed over 1.5 million people. The Khmer Rouge wanted to bring Cambodia back to the year zero. So they banned all wealth and education. The biggest target were intellectuals. And that was bad news for my father. You see, my father was a teacher. He was a well-known teacher and an entertainer in our village. So there's no way for him to hide his status. Surely enough, after the Khmer Rouge took over, they came for him. On the night they took him, he was at a neighbor's house, making people laugh and smile. And soldiers were scouting the house, making sure they keep an eye on him. And when he came home, they showed up. "We're here to take you to Angka." Angka is a generic word for government, the word that the Khmer Rouge use when they take people away. My father began to cry because he knew what's about to happen. He begged for mercy, but they were merciless. They tied him up. They dragged him out. And they beat him to death outside of town. That was the last time I saw my father. And my mother said, "Don't ever talk about him again. Because if the soldier hear about it, they'll come and take us all away and go join them." After they kill my father, they move us to another town. We were there. I was 6 years old. My two sisters were 4 and 2 years old. We were there not too long. And in the middle of the night, they came for my mother. Again, they invoke Angka. But my mother was strong. She did not cry. She later told me the reason why. She said, "If I cry, I will give them a reason to take you too." So they take her away from us and left the children with our old grandmother. It's been months, nobody have heard of my mother. And I was beginning to think that she's not alive anymore. But one night, she appeared like a ghost. "Why are you haunting us?" my grandma said. "You left us. Leave us alone." "Yeah, damn," my mother replied. "Khyom mun men khmoy te. Khyom nou roh." She said, "I am not a ghost. I'm alive." So what happened was, the Khmer Rouge soldiers took her to a work camp instead of killing her. But she's gone for so long, and she's worried about her children. So she took the risk of escaping from the work camp just to check up on her children. That was my mother. But she had to return before the soldier noticed that she was gone. I didn't want to let her go. I miss her. After a couple weeks later, I was determined to go find her, even if it meant going alone at the age of 7. I was able to convince my grandmother to let me go. I didn't know where the work camp was, except the general directions. So I joined a group of people that was going that way. And partway through the walk, we had to split way. They told me to go that way, through that jungle. On the other side, the work camp is over there. Alone, into the jungle. It was a very thick jungle, full of noises and creatures. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. So I decided to turn back around, but then I was lost. I don't remember the way that I was going in or came out. I began to cry. I cried and I cried. Then I gathered myself up and said, I can't be in here. It's getting dark. I have to keep going, even if it meant just going. It doesn't matter where I'm going. I just go. So I eventually found my way out. As I arrived at the work field, my mother was right there. She stood up from her work. She saw me, shocked. What are you doing here? I did not respond. Tears were falling from my eyes. I was too choked up. She ran to me and comforted me with her hug. Up to this day, I still don't know how I found her. We eventually returned to our hometown of Zhangkau. So Zhangkau used to tame with the life of the people living there. But now, the village itself seems dead. And my mother knew that there is no life there for us. There would be no opportunity for anything. So she made another decision. She want us to have a better life, so she made a decision to escape Cambodia. We joined up with a group of escapees, about 100 of us. We walk only at night, so we wouldn't be seen. We walk through the fields, through the hills, through the trees, intense silence. Our eyes and ears were attuned to the possibility of stepping on a landmine or on a trap or just run into soldiers. It was crazy. But one incident that I remember really well. We were about to cross this road, this main road, an embankment. Military vehicle patrol passed now and then. If we were caught, they would kill us for sure. Just when we were about to make a run for it, a baby in our group started to cry. We stop and we discuss, what are we going to do? What should we do? Some people say, maybe we should leave the family and the baby behind. And some say, maybe we should kill the baby to protect our cover. Well, no one had the heart to kill the baby. And we waited and waited until it was getting close to sunrise. So we had to get out. We had to get across. So we decided to leave the family and the baby behind. But then a miracle happened. The crying stopped. Now what? Should we risk crossing the road with the baby? What if it wake up and cry again? So we all decided that we came together, we're going to go together. Miraculously, we made it across safely, everyone. Finally, we got to our destination, a refugee camp in Thailand. See, Lombok refugee camp was where my life truly started. It was my pearly gates of heaven. You say, how can a refugee camp be a heaven? Well, for me, it was. It's where I got to be a kid for the very first time. I went to school. I watched a movie. And I made friends. And for the very first time in my life, I didn't have to worry about finding food or soldier taking me in. The community at Lombok refugee camp was so strong and supportive and helpful to one another that I want to build the same community here in Portland. But imagine, you know, I, as a child, Lombok refugee camp was what I would imagine up to be. Place of heaven. As a child of the killing field, I imagine a lot. Imagine there's no country. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I know I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join us and the world will be as one. Thank you.
In 2012, Saron, along with his wife and his mother, opened a restaurant and event venue together, Mekong Bistro, which serves Cambodian and Laos cuisine in the Portland, Oregon area. 14 years later, Saron's mother is still at the restaurant, helping with daily setup and some cooking. She is an incredible woman, Saron remarks. In a correspondence to Saron, I wrote, "The first time I listened to the audio version of your story, I was in my kitchen making lunch. When you got to the part about your mom, I had to stop what I was doing and sit down. When you were a 7-year-old boy going to find your mom, and when you found her, I imagined my own son and me." I went on to say that his story made me hug my own son a little bit tighter. I suppose if we can take anything from the stories today,
besides the unjust and atrocious, unnecessary terribleness of war, it is to never take for granted the loved ones in our lives. And if we can, to hug our loved ones, our parents, our spouses, our nieces, our sons, just a little bit tighter. Immigrant Story Live is a production of The Immigrant Story. This episode was produced, hosted, and edited by me, Meg Ritter, with audio post-production by Greg Palmer. Our executive producer is Sankar Raman. All stories were part of I'm an American Live, a series of storytelling events showcasing Asian American voices staged in various venues in Portland, Oregon. This episode is part of the Oregon Rises Above Hate series, generously funded by Ann Nato Campbell. If you want to catch up on our past live events, don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at The Immigrant Story Live. For more stories, visit theimmigrantstory.org/manyroads, listen live at prp.fm, or stream us wherever you get your podcasts.